We are continuing our series in Genesis, looking at the life of Joseph, the original Joe. And as we've seen, Joseph at the age of 30, after 13 years in slavery and in prison, he steps into an incredible God-ordained position, second in command of all of Egypt, where he basically, through his work and through God working through him, he brings salvation to his whole family, and ultimately through his family, he preserves the lineage of the coming Savior, Messiah, Jesus Christ. And so God was doing more in his life than he could ever imagine, especially in the times where he felt like, I'm in jail, I'm a slave, what could God possibly be doing? And God was certainly present and active, even in times when Joseph didn't feel like that was true. So we see this amazing faithfulness of God, how he can use Joseph and take him through all that time. But what we're going to do today is we're going to zero in on a moment in Joseph's life that could have dismantled it all. We've been looking big picture, looking at the whole story, but now we want to zoom in on one part of the narrative where something happened that could have dismantled everything for Joseph. He could have made a decision that would have sent him in a radically different direction and messed the whole thing up. We're going to read from Genesis chapter 39, verse 1 to 23. Genesis 39. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. The Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and of all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. So Potiphar left everything he had in Joseph's care. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate. Now Joseph was well-built and handsome. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, "Come to bed with me." But he refused. "With me in charge," he told her, "my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns, he has entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?" And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her. One day he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, "Come to bed with me." But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. When she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out of the house, she called her household servants. "Look," she said to them, "this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us. He came in here to sleep with me, but I screamed. When he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house." She kept his cloak beside her until his master came home. Then she told him this story: "That Hebrew slave you brought us came to me to make sport of me. But as soon as I screamed for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house." When his master heard the story, his wife told him, saying, "This is how your slave treated me." He burned with anger. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. But while Joseph was there in prison, the Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. This morning we're talking about the way out of temptation. The way out of temptation. Now, Joseph's temptation here wasn't just the temptation to go to bed with Potiphar's wife. But as I mentioned at the beginning, it was a temptation that would distract him from God's ultimate purpose and destiny for his life. It would get him off track. It would have messed everything up in Joseph's life. And see, we need to realize that our temptation and our own sin isn't just an issue of the moment, but is often a much greater issue. There's often potentially much greater and drastic results to our sin than just something in the moment that happens. And in Joseph's life, I certainly believe that if he had given in to this temptation, we might not have read about him. We might not have seen him in the position he was in, and God would have had to raise up someone else to take his place. So at this point in Joseph's life, he's not married. My guess is he was probably a virgin. He had no prospects of getting married because he was a slave So he's, you know, totally at the disposal of his master. Here he is in this house. There's no reason to ever believe he would not be a slave at any point. And so here's Potiphar's wife coming to him and making it really easy. I think, Joseph, come to bed with me. She wasn't playing hard to get. She wasn't playing a game. She wasn't, you know, messing with him or anything. She just said, hey, Joseph, here it is. Come and get it, and I want you to come and get it, right? Straight up. So that made it incredibly difficult for Joseph to say no, and especially because he was a slave. He had to be around her. He had to be in the house, but he actually tried his best at all occasions to not even be close to her, but she kind of caught him in a moment where she probably dismissed the rest of the slaves and had Joseph alone with her. See, Joseph could have thought that this is the only way to make a good situation out of a bad situation. I'm not going to get married. I'll probably never really have a chance like this with another woman. I might as well just give in to this temptation. But Joseph believed, and he had faith in the faithfulness of God, that God still had a greater purpose for him. 1 Corinthians 10:13 is a very important passage about temptation. The Apostle Paul writes to us, "No temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can endure it." See, the temptation in this room right now is to say, oh, we're talking about a story of temptation. This isn't really, you know, something that really is important for me to really listen to. But I sure hope that so-and-so is here because they really mess up all the time and this might help them to overcome their temptation. So I hope they're listening and I take notes so I can talk to them about it later, right? But the verse right before I just read, verse 12 of 1 Corinthians 10, says, if you think you are standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. So this is for all of us. Because the passage we read says, when you are tempted, not if, not, remember when you used to get tempted, when you are tempted. And he teaches us how we deal with temptation and shows us the faithfulness of God to help us find the way out. So this is for all of us. First of all, what is temptation? Temptation, in its simplest definition, is a strong urge or desire to do something. Biblically, it's a strong urge or desire to do something that's sinful, that's against God's heart, that's against his will and word. You know, we can have strong urges or desires to do something good, right? And that's a good thing. That's actually the goal. That's the goal of the transformation of our heart that Christ is doing in us. The Christian life isn't about having to stop doing things we really want to do and start doing things we don't want to do. That's not what this is about. In fact, what the Christian life is a continual transformation of our heart and our mind so that our will and God's will become aligned. So that all the things we really, really want to do are all the things that are best for us and best for the people around us. That's the goal. And that's what's possible, that our desires would align with God's so that we can follow our heart. So we can do the things that feel good. So we can do the things we really want to do because those are the same things that God wants us to do. That's the transformation process. But we do know in reality, we're all kind of in one place or another in our actual situation. There are many times where our will is over here and God's will is over here. So we're trying to fight this so that we can align ourselves with the will of God. You know, I'm not tempted to do sit-ups. You know, I don't sit on my couch and go, man, if I'm not careful, I'm going to be on the floor doing 100 sit-ups in no time. Right? I'm not tempted to do yard work, right? I am not tempted at all to go out and be like, oh man, look at all the weeds. I can't wait to get at those weeds. No, hold off, Dave. Don't do too much yard work. That's not my experience. My experience is that I'm tempted to do no exercise, and I'm tempted to just let my yard just completely overgrow. That's the constant temptation, right? Because the things that are good and things that we need to do are actually harder to do than to just give in to temptation. And that's our first clue as to whether what we're desiring is sin or not. Is it a shortcut? Is it a shortcut? Joseph was said, hey, you can come and just have me right now, Joseph. You don't have to wait for God's purposes. You don't have to wait for the woman he has for you. We can just do this right now. We can just take a shortcut and you can have the satisfaction you want right now instead of having to wait. But no, being physically fit takes a lot of effort, having a nice garden and a nice yard takes a lot of effort, and that's the fruit we truly want, but we're often tempted to take shortcuts to try to have satisfaction now instead of greater satisfaction later. But what sin is actually settling for less than what we could have if we follow God. Am I right? Like, sin is always less. In fact, what sin is only a perversion of something good that God created. I mean, think of any sin you can think of. All it is a perversion. It's something less than the great and beautiful gift that God gave us on this world. And so it's always going to ask us to take shortcuts. Craig Groeschel narrows down the definition of temptation further. He says, anything that promises satisfaction at the cost of obedience to God. That's what temptation is. Here's satisfaction that I'm promising you, but if you want this, you have to disobey God. That's what temptation does. Now, in the business world, there's a term that's used. It's opportunity cost. I don't know if you've heard of this term, opportunity cost. What that means is if you're going to do this, it will cost you this opportunity, right? If we're going to spend money here, we don't have that money to spend over here. If we're going to hire someone for this department, we can't hire anyone for this department because we have a limited amount of resources, we have a limited amount of time, and a limited amount of energy. In church, if we want to start this ministry, we can't start this ministry. The church can't do everything. We need to focus on specifically what God has called us to and be the best at that. But by doing this, we lose the opportunity to do this. We need to constantly remind ourselves how our actions and our thoughts, all the things we do, affect our ability to do other things. It's an opportunity cost, and that's what temptation does. Right? Summer's coming. We can have a beach body or a cookie. Right? One or the other. You can't do both. You can maybe buy some new clothes or go on a weekend away. Right? These are opportunity costs. We can't always have both. Now, I don't know if anybody has heard, there's a new Christian satire website called the Babylon Bee. It's a satire of, it's supposed to be a Christian newspaper, and it tells satirical stories, made-up stories that kind of hit close to home, especially about things about church and Christian culture, and it's very interesting. And I read an article on there. Remember, this is made up, but doesn't mean it's not true. I'm not trying to offend anybody, but feel free to be offended. So here's the news site. Here's the headline. After 12 years of quarterly church attendance, parents shocked by daughter's lack of faith. Local father Trevor Michelson, 48, and his wife Carrie, 45, are reeling after discovering that after 12 years of steadily taking their daughter Janie to church every Sunday, they didn't have a more pressing sporting commitment, which was at least once every 3 months. She no longer demonstrates the strong quarterly commitment to the faith they raised her with now that she is college-aged. Trevor Michelson is simply stunned at the revelation. I just don't understand it. Almost every single time there was a rained-out game or a break between school and club team seasons, we had Janie in church. It was at least once per quarter. And aside from one tournament in 2011, we never missed an Easter. It was obviously a priority in our family. I just don't get where her spiritual apathy is coming from. Quote, I can't tell you how often we prayed the prayer of Jabez on the way to a game, added Janie's mother. You know, the more I think about it, the more this illustrates how the church just keeps failing this generation, lamented Trevor, citing a recently Googled study by Barna or someone. The Michelsons further noted plans to have a chat with the pastor of their church after their younger son Robert's soccer season calms down a little bit. All right? Opportunity cost. You know, we're not against sports at Bethel Church. That's not what this is about. But there's an opportunity cost. If we want to do this, we can't do this. If we want to take opportunities over here, we can't take them over here. And temptation isn't always to do something necessarily bad. Putting your kids in sports is important and good. But temptation can be to do something that's just distracting, that just gets us off course, that takes us in a direction that over time is going to lead us to the wrong destination. We're always presented with these costs. What opportunities are you unwilling to let pass by? So what do we have to do to make sure we maintain those opportunities and do not get distracted away from them? So where does temptation come from? You know, where we read in 1 Timothy 1:12 to 15 that temptation doesn't come from God. We read this, when tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each person is tempted when they are dragged away and enticed by their own evil desire. They are dragged away by their own evil desire and enticed. Then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. So these passages point out the origin of temptation. It starts with our own evil desires. It starts with the desires within us that are misaligned, out of order, over-desiring this and under-desiring what is good. It starts in our hearts. So sometimes temptation isn't about pushing everything away and hiding from a sinful culture, but it starts with dealing with what's inside of us first. Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote about temptation, and he writes powerfully. He says, "In our members there is a slumbering inclination towards desire, which is both sudden and fierce. With irresistible power, desire seizes mastery over the flesh. All at once, a secret smoldering fire is kindled. The flesh burns in its flames." Isn't that potent? And that's exactly how it feels when we're tempted. There's just this fire, and we're consumed by it, and all our focus goes in one direction, and it feels like we can't overcome it. It's completely overwhelming us. As Paul writes to Timothy, it's like we're being dragged away by our own desires and enticed by them. We've lost control over ourselves. Those are those desires within us. But the other side of temptation is that there's an external bait. There's an external influence, a stimulus outside of us that begins the fire burning in us. Joseph's temptation began with Potiphar's wife approaching him, but then it partnered with the desires in his own heart. See, our friends can ask us to do something we shouldn't do. We can get distracted from the priorities in our life because there's something else that we're looking for. There's that extra piece of cake. There's that temptation over here. How many of us this month were doing our taxes, right? How tempting is it to just make a little, just little change in something just to make sure things go our way? But our external stimulus and opportunities outside of us can stimulate, spur on the temptation and desires in our heart. See, it was the serpent in the garden who came to Eve and pointed out the fruit and what she could gain from it that then added to the desires in her heart, and those two came together. See, think of it as two magnets, your internal desire and the external stimulation, and they're pulling together in an irresistible force that eventually culminates in us giving in. Now, Paul isn't writing these passages to discourage us. Paul is actually writing this to empower us, to encourage us, and to instruct us in how we can overcome temptation. He says that no temptation has overcome you except what is common to mankind. Anything you're tempted by, there are a million others just like you who are dealing with the same thing. So all of us in here are being tempted. All of us in here are struggling with different things. And so we don't have to feel like we're alone. We don't have to feel like we've got nobody who understands. But everything we're dealing with is a human condition. He's trying to tell us that there's hope, that it's a winnable fight, that there's options, that we can believe for something greater, and we don't have to give in. Most importantly, you're not alone. You're in this together. And we're in this with Jesus. Hebrews 4 says that Jesus was tempted in every way we are. Yet he showed us that it's possible to get through temptation without having sin because he was sinless. So being tempted is not a sin. If you're being tempted, don't suddenly feel guilty as though you've done something wrong. That's just the human condition. We will be tempted. Paul says, when we are tempted, there's something, some things to remember. Secondly, what does temptation do to us? Well, first of all, it tries to convince us that we're alone. Just mentioned this, but no temptation has seized you than that which is not common to man. No, temptation wants you to believe that you're alone. It wants you to believe that you should feel ashamed and guilty already. It wants you to believe that God is unhappy with you and it would just be easier if you gave in and life would just be so much simpler if you took the bait. Joseph realized that he wasn't alone, even though he was alone in the room with Potiphar's wife, even though he didn't have his father, he didn't have his brothers, but he knew that God was with him. Even in the times it didn't feel like it, he knew that God was there, that he was with him at all times, giving him strength. See, if temptation is common to all of us, one of the ways to overcome temptation is community. If it's common, then we need community to overcome it. See, it's trying to convince us that we've got nobody else. It's trying to convince us that no one else understands. It's trying to convince us that we need to separate and get out from the community so that we can be picked off like a sheep that leaves the herd. But we're not alone. You know what? Touch the person beside you and say, me too. Touch them, say, me too. Touch the other person on the other side and say, we're in this together. We're in this together. We just got to declare that to each other. We got to tell one another. We're in this together. We got to open ourselves up. And in community, we together, through the strength of one another, can overcome temptation. You know what's amazing? In the moment where you are tempted the most, where you're so close to giving in, where you're struggling deeply, there's someone who knows you and loves you who is in a position of strength. And if you call that person, if you grab that person, if you go over to their house or call them over to your house, they can offer their strength and take some of your weakness from you. That's what community does. And that's substitutional sacrifice, like Christ on the cross offered us his strength and took on our weakness. We're in this together. We need to call upon one another. Second thing temptation does is it's persistent. Verse 10 of the Genesis passage, she spoke to Joseph day after day. Wouldn't it have been nice if we get tempted and we just have to say no once and then it's over? If Joseph would have just had to say, no, thanks, Mrs. Potiphar, but that's not going to happen. All right, Joseph, thanks. I just thought I'd ask. I won't bug you again. That's not what temptation does. In fact, as long as our circumstances remain the same, temptation will be persistent. As long as we're going to the same place, as long as we're with the same people, as long as we're in the same situation, our temptation will never change. So we need to do something to interrupt the temptation. We need to do something to strip it of its power. Joseph did whatever he could to stay away from her. It says he tried not to even be with her. But as a slave, he couldn't avoid it in the end. And at the very end, he had to actually just run away. He had to get out of that place no matter the consequences that came with it. Temptation is persistent. It's not going to go away. So we have to make adjustments to remove it of its power. Additionally, what temptation does is it makes us forget God. It's probably the most insidious and powerful move that temptation has against us. The first thing it wants us to do is forget about God. See, Satan doesn't want to make us hate God. He'll just settle for making us forget about him for a moment. Just a moment. That's all he needs. Just a moment. Just forget about it for a moment. Eve, forget that God gave you all those trees with all that fruit. Forget that he loves you. Forget that he created this garden and this world for you. Just for a minute, forget about him and think about this. Look at this shiny thing over here. Satan doesn't want us to hate God necessarily. He just wants us to forget about him, even for a moment. It's the first thing that happens. Again, going back to Bonhoeffer, he says, the joy of God gets extinguished as we seek joy elsewhere. The joy of God gets extinguished as we seek joy elsewhere. We get tunnel vision. All we can see is the bait that's in front of us. All we can feel is the desires in our heart that are welling up and burning in that flame. And we forget about God, forget about his faithfulness, we forget about the dreams we have and the destiny he has in front of us. Try to make us forget him. You know what keeps us from sinning? I believe what keeps us from sinning is not fighting, is not being stronger than the temptation, because friends, we're not stronger than temptation. You know what keeps us from doing this? It's having joy in this. It's having joy in God so that we're not seeking joy elsewhere. You know what keeps a man from leaving his wife? Having joy in his wife. He's fully satisfied in her. Why would he need anything else? And if we are fully satisfied in God, if we are fully satisfied in the call he has in our lives, in what he has in store for us, we will not seek joy elsewhere. See, the key to freedom in our temptation is just joy. It's celebrating what he has offered. It's celebrating what he has for us, so we're not seeking it elsewhere. Nehemiah 8:10 says, it's the joy of the Lord that's our strength. It's the joy of the Lord that gives us strength. So what should I do about temptation? James 4, chapter 7 reads this, submit yourselves then to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. See the order of this passage? Submit yourselves to God, resist the devil. It starts not with resistance, not with fighting back. It starts with submission to God. See, our resistance is not powerful enough to save us ourselves, but what is powerful is God. Our passage in 1 Corinthians 10, God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear, but when you're tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can endure it. See, he's the one who provides the way out, so the first thing to do is turn to him. So I think sometimes we get so tunnel visioned on our temptation that we're staring at it. We're going, I don't want to do that. That. I don't want to do that. That thing. God, I don't want to do that thing. God's up here going, look at me. You know, and even when we're praying to God, we're focusing, we're praying about the temptation we're facing. And what that does is it puts temptation in the middle of everything. God's saying, I don't want you to even pray about the temptation. I want you to just worship me. Just forget about the temptation itself. Turn to God and worship me. It starts with submitting to him. It starts with an act of worship. It starts with glorifying and praising God. You ever been in a room with someone you really don't like? Don't point at them right now. And you're in the room and you got your opinions about them, and someone else comes in and they start saying all these wonderful things about that person you can't stand. And you're just like, oh man, you guys don't even know, and you're trying to keep your mouth shut, and you know that they're wrong, you know they have no idea how horrible and terrible this person is and all the things that they've done. What does it make you want to do? You want to leave. You want to get out of there because you can't stand someone praising someone that you can't stand. That's exactly how Satan feels when we worship God. Our submission to God and our act of worship to him makes him flee. Remember how I told you the internal desire and the external stimulus of sin and temptation pulls together like a magnet? What happens when one magnet turns around? The polarity is reversed and it repels. And when we repent, and repentance is a change of mind, it's a change of focus, it's a change of direction, it focuses back on God, it repels the enemy and he can't touch us. It comes through worship. 2 Corinthians 3:18 talks about as we contemplate the Lord's glory, as we experience his presence, as we focus on him, as we expose ourselves to his awesomeness, then we are transformed more and more into the image of his son. See, it's the act of worship that transforms us, not the act of trying really hard not to sin. That's a focus on sin. Focus on God transforms us, and it brings that alignment between our will and God's will closer and closer together, and our desires align with his. Thomas Chalmers, he said, the only way to dispossess the heart of an old affection is by the expulsive power of a new one. Temptation doesn't just go away. We don't lose our desire or our passion. We redirect it to a new desire, a new object of worship and glory in our lives, and the temptation melts away because it becomes a secondary issue, because our primary love is for something else. So submit to God, that's the first way, the first thing we do as we are tempted. Second thing, when it comes down to it, run. Just like Joseph, he did his best, he did what he could, but there came a moment where he just had to get out of there. He just had to get out of there. David Robinson was an NBA basketball player, won a couple championships. I think he was like 7 feet tall. He was a believer. And after a while, commentators and critics began to notice something that he would do during a timeout. He would sit on the bench, and during timeouts in a basketball game, the cheerleaders are out on the floor, and they're jumping around, and they're doing their thing. And David Robinson would be sitting on the bench, staring between his feet with a towel over his head. And then they also noticed that when young women would come up to him and ask for an autograph or want to talk to him, he would just very rudely just blow them off, walk away, say, see you later. And they finally cornered him, and they asked him, why do you do that? Why are you so rude to these women? You're going to hurt feelings. You're going to make people upset. And he said this, if any woman is going to get her feelings hurt, it's not going to be my wife. Right? He just knew that in his life, he needed to run. He needed to get out of there. It didn't matter whose feelings were hurt. It didn't matter what happened. He just had to get out of that place. 1 Corinthians 6:18 says, flee from sexual immorality. 2 Timothy 2:22 says, flee youthful passions and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace, along with those who call on the Lord from a pure heart. You don't have to be youthful to have youthful passions, by the way. flee those things and pursue. It's not just running away from them, it's pursuing God, it's pursuing his righteousness, love, faith, and peace, along with the rest of those who call on the Lord from a pure heart. I want you to think for a moment as we move toward a close, the symbolism of this story. Verse 12, we read, Potiphar's wife caught him by his cloak and said, "Come to bed with me," but he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. When Joseph was 17 years old, his father gave him an ornate robe. And that robe gave him an identity. It showed his position in the household. And his brothers attacked him and tore that robe from his body and used it in an elaborate lie to tell their father that he'd been killed as they sold him into slavery. Comes to Potiphar's house and he receives a robe and he receives authority in the household. And Potiphar's wife tears that robe from his body and uses it in an elaborate lie to have him sent off to jail. Once he comes out of jail and enters Pharaoh's service, he stands before Pharaoh and Pharaoh gives him authority and he puts what? A robe on him to symbolize his identity and his position in the kingdom. You see, we all have an identity. We've all put a robe on. But those first two robes of Joseph's weren't really his permanent identity. The first one was really out of his father's sin and favoritism for him. The second one was not his end, the end result he was looking for. He was a slave in a household. But God's destiny was for him to be a ruler. God's destiny was to save his people, and he received that third robe. Some of us just need to just start with casting off the identity that we've put on ourselves. Sometimes we find our identity in the things that are tempting us to be like this, to be this person. The world is trying to give us an identity that we just need to cast off before it's torn off. We read in the New Testament, we read this, Romans 13:14, "Clothe yourselves with the Lord Jesus Christ and do not think about how to gratify the desires of the flesh." Clothe yourselves with him. Put on his identity. Put on his life. That means put on his righteousness, his character. Cover yourself with his love and acceptance and under his forgiveness. You know, Jesus hung on the cross naked and disrobed so that we would never have to be naked and disrobed, so that we could have an identity, so that we could be in him, so that we could be clothed with his righteousness. He was exposed to our sin. Clothe yourselves with Christ. As we've read each week, Romans 8:28, "In all things, God works for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose." See, the devil meant to take Joseph's temptation and use it for evil, to distract him, to get him off course, to dismantle his destiny. But God was able to actually take it and hijack it and use it for good. He turned Joseph's temptation into training. See, God doesn't tempt us, but he will take our temptation and use it to train us and fit us for his kingdom and his purposes that he has in our life. So let's look at our own temptation and not feel guilty, not feel discouraged, but feel hopeful. Submit ourselves to God and say, "God, how are you going to use this to transform me into the person you want me to be? Clothe me with Christ. Give me your identity so I'm not tempted by any other way of thinking or doing life. Help prepare me for the goal you have for me." Let me pray for you. Father, I thank you that you are faithful. You are so faithful, and you do not let us be tempted in ways that we can't overcome them. And you provide the way out. Lord, the way out is submission to you. It's turning to you. It's being clothed with Christ and taking on his identity so we're not tempted to do anything else that would distract us from the ultimate purposes you have in mind for us, the dreams you've given us about your kingdom. So God, I pray that in every way your kingdom would come and will be done in our lives as it is in heaven. Lord, I pray that each person here, including myself, we have sin in our lives. We have fallen under temptation. We've messed up. Thank you that all that is taken care of under Christ, and we are clothed with his righteousness. We're clothed with his acceptance and forgiveness. And we are your children. So God, if there's any person here who just needs to receive that forgiveness today and receive your strength to live differently today. I pray that you would speak to their hearts in this moment.